Life just got a little easier for travelers flying in and out of Honolulu's Daniel K. Inouye International Airport. Ride-sharing services Uber and Lyft can now legally pick up riders at the airport. That's as of December 1st. Previously, taxi companies were the only commercial ride drivers allowed to pick up passengers. The case of rideshare versus taxis is a classic example of the economic debate over government regulation. An older, established service provider lobbies government to keep potential competitors from entering the market. In economics parlance, this is the battle between incumbents and entrants. One theory says some types of regulation most benefit the incumbent, in this case a cab company, by preventing would-be competitors from gaining access to customers. It's an idea known as regulatory capture. That real-world impacts of those theories are explored in a new book called The Captured Economy. The authors argue that regulatory capture is slowing growth and increasing income equality in the U.S. economy. Our producer, Ryan Finnerty, sat down to discuss it with co-author Brink Lindsay.
So, Brink, your book starts by stating that slow growth and increasing inequality shouldn't happen simultaneously, according to economic theory. Can you start by explaining why that shouldn't happen and why you think we are experiencing it in real life?
Yeah, economists have formulated a big trade-off between efficiency on the one hand and equality on the other. So often measures that are designed to grow the pie faster, make the slices of pie more unequal, and those measures that work to equalize the slices of pie may slow the rate at which the pie grows. But in our current state of affairs, we have a number of government policies that are simultaneously pushing in the direction of greater inequality and are doing so in a way that undermines economic growth. So even though this trade-off normally applies, when government policies actively contribute to inequality and slow growth, then the trade-off disappears, and you can have kill two birds with one stone policy reforms that simultaneously brighten prospects for the overall economy and work to ensure that a high-growth economy redounds to the benefits of all.
So you're not saying that the fundamental trade-off between equality and efficiency is a bad thing. It's just the manner in which we're doing it right now. Can you give some examples historically of when society has benefited from an increase in efficiency that decreases equality?
Well, let's look at China over the past 40 years. China started out extremely equal. Everybody was impoverished on the verge of starvation. Over the course of 40 years, you've had one of the greatest success stories in the history of Homo sapiens, hundreds of millions of people rescued from the precipice of grinding want. And yet that has made the inequality statistics look like they're getting worse. You still have a whole lot of poor people, but now you have a bunch of middle class and rich people too, so the overall spread of incomes has increased. I would argue that society of China today is much, much, much better off overall than it was 40 years ago, and that has occurred because, to some extent, economic growth has occurred at the expense of greater inequality, but that greater inequality has bought greater absolute living standards for all.
Okay. And so, like all things in the world of economics, there's a trade-off between those two ideas, and your book seems to argue that here in the United States, we've gone too far in the direction of inequality, and you cite government regulation that limits competition as one of the big reasons. Can you explain that idea?
Yeah, here we've seen a big takeoff in income inequality, the share of total income that goes to the people at the very top. But that has not occurred, as in the case of China, against a backdrop of roaring economic growth and rising living standards for all. On the contrary, it's occurred against a backdrop of slowing economic growth and decreasing and dimming economic prospects for many, if not most, people. So this is the malaise that we're in the middle of, this combination of slow growth and high inequality, which means that for most people, what growth there is isn't redounding much to their benefit. So there are a lot of different causes for these troubles. We're not saying that we have this silver bullet that explains everything, but one underreported, neglected cause is, we believe, government policies that by stymieing competition, distorting markets, and doing so in a way that redistributes income upwards, that government is actively part of the problem as well as part of the solution, and so that reforming these policies is a really fruitful way of getting out of our current economic funk.
So for the listeners out there who haven't studied economic theory, can you just give a basic explanation of regulatory theory and capture and incumbents versus entrants and how
Sure.
this whole thing works?
Yeah, so a lot of, when people think about regulation, they usually think about costs that are being imposed on businesses in the form of health, safety, environmental, and worker rules. So a bunch of procedures that companies have to go through to make sure that they don't harm people. And those procedures could be onerous from the business perspective, and the business doesn't want to go to incur all those costs. So you have this back and forth between business groups that want less regulation and consumer, environmental, public interest groups that want more regulation so that corporations' capacity to harm people is restricted. So that's what we normally think about as regulation, and it's a very set ideological battle between the left and the right, and the truth is often somewhere in the middle between them. In the present case, though, the regulations we're talking about are different. These aren't regulations that are costs imposed on current businesses. They're subsidies to current businesses by making it more difficult for competition to enter the field. So we talk about occupational licensing, where about one-third of jobs now, you have to get permission from the government before you can do that job. Back in 1970, it was only about 10% of jobs so covered. So there's been a huge expansion in these barriers to entry that make it more difficult for people to enter jobs. At the bottom of the economic scale, it makes it extremely difficult for disadvantaged people, immigrants, people without college degrees, to start their own businesses and start on the path of upward mobility. At the high end, it takes high-end professionals like doctors and lawyers and inflates their incomes even more artificially. So doctors and lawyers between them make up about 25% of the top 1% of income earners, and their earnings are inflated greatly by restrictions on who can compete with them. Intellectual property, patents, and copyrights are temporary monopolies given to people to encourage artistic expression, encourage invention. But these monopolies have grown in scope and in duration to such an extent that we believe that they are, instead of encouraging artistic expression and innovation, actually actively discouraging them by creating a kind of legal minefield for anybody who wants to come out with a new product, and doing so in a way that is creating mega fortunes in Hollywood, Big Pharma, and in Silicon Valley.
So, Brink, what's the real-world impact to the normal person working 40 hours a week out there? And then the follow-up, what kinds of changes need to be made within our regulatory system to make things more equal and bring some competition back?
So the bottom line impact is, first, the economy in the 21st century is growing at half the rate it grew on average during the 20th century. So that means someone born in the year 2000, by the time she's an old lady, if current growth rates persist, then the economy will be about double the size of when she was born. If growth rates during the 20th century persisted, instead, the economy would be four times as big. So the sort of 100% variation in the size of the economy over the course of an average lifetime is the stakes we're talking about. Put on top of that inequality, so that if you're having growth and most of it's going to the top, ordinary people aren't seeing any of it, that makes the situation even worse. So in terms of just the prospects for you to do better over the course of your life and for your kids to do better than you, that is all directly impacted by this double whammy of slow growth and high inequality. On election night 2016, only 30% of Americans told pollsters that they expected their children to be better off than they are. I think that had a lot to do with the election results and a lot of the political problems we're facing these days. And if we don't solve that problem, if we don't create the prospect of a brighter future for more Americans, we're going to be facing more of the same. As to what to do about it, in our book, we don't offer a laundry list of specific policy changes. Instead, what we do is offer kind of institutional fixes to make the whole policy-making process less vulnerable to insiders taking over and manipulating. A lot of that has to do with getting third parties in the philanthropic community and the nonprofit community to take this issue seriously and push back against the moneyed interests that are causing mischief. It has to do with improving the government's capacity to develop its own information so it doesn't have to rely on lobbyists when it's writing bills. It has its own in-house analytical capacity. That has been cut badly in recent decades, even as the scope of government has grown, so that government policymakers just don't know what they're doing and have to rely on insiders with their biased information to make policy. That often leads policy in the wrong direction. So these kinds of institutional fixes are what we're looking for as a way to make the overall policy process less vulnerable to hijacking.
And continuing that thought, in your book, it states that around the world, if we look at international governments, bigger governments tend to do better than smaller governments at controlling corruption and what's called rent seeking or lobbying. Could you explain why that is?
Yeah, we don't think that the big government versus small government distinction is very useful here. That you can have that usually is looking at how much government spends as a percentage of GDP, whereas we're looking at the regulatory side. A government that doesn't spend very much at all can still have terrible laws that ruins its economy. Lots of less developed countries in the Middle East and Africa have much smaller governments than we do, and they manage to wreak havoc with those small governments. On the other hand, the richest, best governed, least corrupt societies tend to be the very large welfare states, generous welfare states of Northern Europe. So you could have big government and good government going together. You can have small government and bad government going together. And so our point is that we should be focusing on good government versus bad government rather than big versus little.
All right. The book is called The Captured Economy, How the Powerful Enrich Themselves, Slow Down Growth, and Increase Inequality. Brink Lindsey is the co-author, and he's also the director and vice president of the Open Society Project at the Niskanen Center in Washington, D.C. Brink, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you so much.